You're listening to the Jason Greger Show podcast, brought to you by Lakewood Chev. Celebrate Canada's 150th and treat yourself to a brand new Silverado. 20% off MSRP cash credit on select vehicles right now at Lakewood Chev. Portions of this hour brought to you by Big Rock. Stick with an original traditional ale, the perfect beer to enjoy the summer. Visit them online at bigrockbeer.ca.
The Jason Greger Show, presented by Grand Villa Casino. Sip, dine, play. Let the excitement begin on your home for Edmonton sports, TSN 1260.
Just after 5 o'clock in Edmonton Sports Theater, TSN 1260. I'm Jason Greger, along with Mark Majot, and we welcome back to the studio. Joins us every Tuesday from 5 until 6, a little football 101 with the former member of the USC Trojans, Dallas Cowboys, Edmonton Eskimos, won 2 great cups as a player, and then another one as a GM. Ed Hervey joins us, and Ed, as a guy who was at NCAA, in the NFL and the CFL, what would be your words of advice for Ezekiel Elliott right now?
Well, I think the first thing I would probably suggest is, you know, make sure that you put yourself in a situation where you don't get into trouble. I mean, your status with the team, the impact, the responsibility that you have for the organization is much higher than anyone that you could be hanging with outside of your teammates. And if you're in a situation where you have to get into a fight, or you're driving 100 miles an hour to a 70 zone, you need to really reassess the current situation, because as we've seen in sports, you know, things can change really quickly when the law gets involved.
Yeah, well, you do wonder, when troubles seems to follow you, then at some point you have to look and say, you can't always play the victim and say, oh, Jesus, just bad place, bad time, wrong place, wrong time. Eventually you got to look in the mirror and say, I need to make better decisions.
Yeah, you have to look within, clearly. I mean, it's unfortunate that, he goes through that, and, you have those players, young players that go through that, they get the success, and who knows, right? His life probably was always filled with these things. They just never were under the microscope. And now, being a professional athlete, especially in Dallas, knowing that city and that team, everything you do is under the microscope. And being who he is, just people are watching. And today, with social media and people being able to film and with their phones, you're not going to be able to get away with a whole lot. My advice to him would just be, be careful where you go. And when you do go to places, make sure that practice self-control.
Now, it's been a while since you were at USC, of course, over 20 years. But did you have meetings back then when you come to college? Did they give you, okay, this is what we'd like you not to do? And how strict were they about, or often did they try to reinforce players to be in the right place and make right decisions?
Well, you have to understand that when you go to a university, you're a college student. So you're not a professional. You're an amateur athlete under a scholarship, and it is the university's rules, obviously, made by the head coach. So, when you get on campus, the first thing they talk to you about is conduct. Your orientation is conduct, on how to handle yourself on campus, classwork. Everything they teach you about the area. I was from Los Angeles, so I pretty much knew. But the players that came from outside of California, outside the Los Angeles area, everything was explained to you in an orientation. Don't go to this side of town because crazy things can happen. Stay here. Don't do this, and understand that you represent the University of Southern California, and anything that you do out there will reflect badly on you, the university, and your family. And then you're on your way. And then guys would kind of be in one ear and out the other for some guys. And,
yeah.
And then some guys have no, discipline, and things just happen. But yes, the university does give you that and gives you that fair warning to understand that everything that you do, you know, you're grown now and, you know, you're going to take some responsibility in yourself, but you are still a university student. So yeah, it's a little different from professional where you come, you get drafted, you get a check. They give you the rundown, but for the most part, you're on your own.
Should pro teams, especially, you know, when you have young players and nowadays, you know, millionaires, all of a sudden you come out of college, you're 21 years of age, and some players are getting $3-4 million, and many of them came from real tough backgrounds. Should teams do more to try to educate their players on how to act responsibly with their money, but also responsibly maybe? Because for you, instance, in the neighborhood you grew up in, it's much different than the average neighborhood for most people, right? And luckily for you, you had a really strong mother who was pretty strict in certain things, but a lot of guys that you grew up with didn't have that. Is that something you think the NFL and even the CFL and other leagues should do more to help young players? Because once you have $1 million salary, you kind of got a bullseye on your back from leeches and people that are just trying to either get a piece of you, or a lot of people that are trying to say, you know what, I hope I can goat this guy to punch me because then I'll sue him.
I think the NFL does have seminars during the combine where they talk to the players, and they have these rookie symposiums and stuff. But yeah, you have to understand that, you know, each player is different, and you're right. You can ask someone that's 18, 19, 20 years old that's, going to probably be drafted in the first round of the NFL. But if you ask them when they're 15, 16, 17 years old, and ask what their dream is to play professionally and make a lot of money. But no one ever asks them, you know, do you know what to do with that money when you get it? You know, how are you going to take care of it and make sure that it lasts? A lot of players, and I'm not going to say that every player, but there are players out there who, when they get to that status, you know, they believe that they can't be told anything by anyone, and they feel like, hey, they've arrived, and sometimes your, you know, flaws in your personality come to the forefront. Just because, you know, you just feel like you can do that. And for the most part, you know, when you're coming up through sports, particularly in football, you know, you tend to say that the guy who's the elite athlete tends to get shoved by and not disciplined as hard as the average guy who's on the same team, right? The guy who seems to be the best player, you know, in times coaches tend to just kind of let him go and do what he needs to do. And that player, just like a bad parent, grows up with these habits that he feels he can get away with because he's an elite athlete. And from there, you know, when they do get this money, the money in their minds gives you this power to do whatever you want because you become untouchable, so to speak. And it isn't until, you know, you find yourself, arrested or in a situation like you see with Ezekiel, where all of a sudden now everyone is on you and talking about you and you're the news and not for a positive. You know, then, you know, some players, you know, see that and they go in a different direction. And then there's other players that just consistently find themselves on the wrong side of the law. I mean, you go back to Tank Williams, you know, if you could run down a list of guys who constantly were always in trouble. And I don't think there's that much a CFL team can do, an NFL team can do, or the league can do.
Okay.
When you get to that stage, that is something that needs to start at the, you know, grassroots level, going all the way through the amateur ranks.
That's fair. Ed Hervey joins us as he always does every Tuesday. And I want to get to a few things. Catching for wide receivers, catching ball. Like, let's say you're running across the field, right? You're running to your right, and the ball's thrown behind you, right? And we saw a lot of it last week, and not many of those balls were caught. What's the key to catching the ball against the grain?
Well, you know, first of all, I mean, there are a variety of reasons why receivers, you know, drop balls. You know, one being you're focusing on the ball. You know, and it sounds obvious, but, you know, some receivers lose focus on the football, you know, and making the catch. And then number two, adjusting to the football. Again, we have some great quarterbacks in this league, but they don't always put the ball where it's supposed to be. But therefore, you know, receivers are paid to adjust to poorly thrown footballs, and the routine catch is expected. So, you know, when you say, how do you fix this problem? You know, it comes in practice, right? You know, you have bad ball drills. You have to continue to work. And the more you practice, the better you are at catching, you know, the football. But again, when you're a receiver, you don't know where the ball is going to be going when it comes out. From practice, it goes right where it's supposed to be. Everything is near perfect. And then when you get in the game, sometimes the timing is off. Sometimes the quarterback's under pressure, but he can get it to you just close enough to where you can make a play on it. And you're right, when the ball is thrown behind you, that is it's easier when you're practicing it in a bad ball drill. But when you get into a game situation, obviously concentration, focus, and then being able to not only adjust your body, but being able to adjust to the football and make the catch. It's a very tough catch, but that's what separates the elite from the average.
What did you do to, because I know a lot of people are like with your speed, and I remember you telling me, you're like, you know what? I didn't catch the ball consistently enough to remain in the NFL. And it's easy to say it. It's a lot harder because you said you can practice all the time with a machine once you get into the game and boom, there it go. What's the key then to being a sure-handed receiver?
I mean, I think you have to practice. I guess, well, my situation, you know, going back, I went from a quarterback to a wideout position and trying to learn the whole, you know, the game. But again, you practice, you know, to be sure-handed. Obviously, it takes lots and lots of reps of anything. You know, there's no simple way to become an elite receiver as far as catching the football. And, you know, the better you are at catching the ball with your hands, the better you are, at sticking and surviving. But also when you're out there catching the ball, you got to get used to catching the ball when someone's on you. You know, you got to get used to running, you know, catching the ball when you're fatigued. There's so many factors into that. But as far as, you know, guys dropping the football, there could be many reasons why a receiver would drop a football. I could tell you that none of them want to drop the ball. You know, everyone wants their stat line to look good. But, you know, they're just sometimes there's a tough ball. And when it comes to that, you just spend more time on it. But again, focusing on it, concentrating and adjusting to the football and putting your hands in position to make the catch, you generally increase your chances of making the play.
Ed Hervey joins us, Football 101. Any text questions you got, you can text him at 101260. Email us in our SLH inbox, Gregor, tsn1260.ca. Quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little more from the perspective and how it changes from a player's mindset to a manager's mindset when you have good starts or bad starts to a season. And when nervousness, maybe how it changes in that philosophy. We'll do that next on The Gregor Show, presented by Grand Villa Casinos.
Portions of this hour brought to you by Cougar Paint and Collision. There, and you need them, call or stop in. No appointment required, as they'll see you right away. You can trust Cougar Paint and Collision. Their family serving your family. 88th Street and Yellowhead Trail. That's Cougar Paint and Collision.
This is the Jason Gregor Show on your home for Edmonton sports, TSN 1260.
Mike 24, Gregor and Ed Hervey with you on Edmonton Sports Leader TSN 1260. Lots of texts flying in. We'll get to those in a second. Lots of Laker questions.
Oh, yeah.
There you go. A few other ones. Now, as a player, when you get off to a bad start as a player, obviously you're frustrated. As a manager, when the team's off to a bad start, how do you weigh the option? Okay, we got to get better players in. You know, are my players good enough? What's the mindset? How different is it from a player on a bad start to a GM on a bad start?
Well, you know, to be quick with the player portion is you're actively in the game, right? So you take your confidence into the game. You concentrate on what's important, one block, you know, one play at a time, one block at a time. You know, you eliminate crowd and opponents and all that other stuff. You just go in and you have to manage your pressure by staying calm and, you know, maintain your poise and make your plays, you know, and embrace every opportunity to be a difference maker because you actually have the opportunity to make a difference on the field. You know, I've always said to guys that, hey, the players are the ones responsible for the game, for the show, no matter what kind of plays you call, you know, all that stuff during the practice, when your coaches are on the field, when the game happens, they're not on the field anymore.
Yeah.
It's the players. So it's what the players put in that week and the confidence that they take in. And, you know, if you're not having a good day or you have a bad call, you have to get past that. And that's part of being the player. As far as, you know, being a general, you know, managing a team, see, I'm a very patient person, you know, and I've always believed that, you know, the group that we brought in was the group that was going to get it done. You know, I always felt like they were good enough when we selected them. And, you know, we had a slow start with our secondary last year. We knew going in, that the secondary was going to be inexperienced in some areas and we were going to take some time to gel. But, you know, and everyone wanted to change in this. And my belief is that the CFL, it's a round robin, right? And, you know, that's how I've always looked at it. It's a round robin year, and, you know, you're never out until you're out. And, I mean, hey, you play everyone twice. You get to Labor Day, that's when the season really starts. And if you can accumulate your points early and do those things, and meanwhile, while the players that are young or inexperienced are getting that experience, if these are the guys that you felt good about in mini camp, felt good about coming into training camp, coming out of training camp and putting your roster together with, you know, I'm a big believer in development and believe that you have to have some patience because they'll be better on the back nine than they are in the front nine. So I guess, you know, everyone's different. Some people want, you know, air cargo and, you know, go through the roster. Hey, we're not, you know, cut 10, bring 10 in, cut 5, bring 5 in. You know, some people like to do that. And I just believe that if all your work in the off season was as good as you believe that it was, then you should be able to pick within the pool of players that you brought to camp and feel good about that.
So then at what point do you look and say, okay, you know what? Maybe I misevaluated on this guy. Right. And so does it take 6 games? Like, is there enough time where you look, say, you know what? Hey, maybe I thought this guy still had it, or we saw something and for whatever reason, he just can't bring it up here.
No, I mean, again, that would be a conversation that you'd have with obviously the, you know, head coach and the coordinator and the position coaches. But again, dependent upon the player and how many plays that he's making versus not making, and you feel like he has the potential to, you know, to make plays. And again, there's someone in-house that you could replace them with, and you can sit someone for a week or two and put someone else in and allow them to give them their opportunity. But, you know, I was always against the wholesale, you know, pick everybody up and dump them out and bring in new guys. I just didn't, you know, I didn't think that style worked. And I think, you know, some people do it to make it look like they're doing a lot of work. But the fact is that, you know, when you spend a lot of time, you know, evaluating during the off season and you feel good, especially when the consensus of the room, coaches, everyone included, is that, you know, you have a pretty good group of players or depth at a certain position, or from your 75-man roster that comes into camp, you should be able to feel good about those guys. Again, sometimes it takes a player too, but, you know, a player can grade out at 90%, 95% and have one play. Give up a big touchdown, but everything else is good. Give up the one touchdown, and some coaches get upset at that and they want him out.
Yeah. It's funny you say that, because we were just talking with Bud Steen about officials where, you know what, you get ground on a few little plays and suddenly grade out at 95 and people are like, well, that's not good enough. I'm like, well, no, that's realistically how it's going to be. Very few players are grading out 100% every game.
Exactly. And so that's, you know, that's what you have to weigh it against sometimes, but, you know, some coaches, you know, look and say, man, this dude, he gives up the big play, but you will see that in practice. If a player constantly gives up the big play in practice, you know, they say, well, he's always around the football. That's a term that we used to say for some of the defensive backs. He's always around the football, but never makes a play on the ball. And you see that consistently, then you know, hey, this guy is going to be on the guy, but he's not going to make a play. When the opponents start making plays over him, you recognize that, you know, hey, it's probably, we probably best to take him out, because teams have figured out that this guy is a guy that is not going to make a play on the football. And you have some guys who, you know, just have a knack for finding the football. You know, they get beat, you look, ball's thrown, recovery speed, and they, you know, they make a play. So as far as it's done individually, but again, it's based on patience. And I've always felt that, you know, be patient with your guys. And if you take a guy and sit him for the week, you get a chance to continue to evaluation. But never was all into the, you know, bringing 10 in and getting 10 out and disrupting the chemistry in the room and making people feel uncomfortable.
Ed Hervey joins us, as he always does, Football 101 every Tuesday from 5 to 6 o'clock here on the Jason Gregor Show. When you got into scouting, Ed, what was the biggest learning curve you found once you got in it?
Well, there's two things. One, you got to make sure that, you know, you're judging offensive linemen, right? So you got this Canadian offensive lineman, you have the American offensive lineman, and you got to be able to determine the two. And if people say, oh, they're all the same, they're not. You know, they're just not. It's, you know, some players are better than others, and some can't play, but some are going to be given an opportunity to play. It's just the way it is. And the other thing you learn is that, you know, there's a lot of, you know, when it comes to coaches, you know, they do a lot of politicking for guys. You know, they want to get a guy and they want to talk to a guy. And, you know, a lot of guys say, well, this guy is good. My guy, my friend over here says he's pretty good. And you have to learn to be able to trust your own evaluation, right? That's the biggest thing, is that everyone wants to influence your decision. But when the decision is on your shoulders and it doesn't go well, you're the one responsible for it. And everyone else kind of just goes, you know, their separate way. That's why I was so, happy the way I did things when I managed. You know, basically we had a structure. I didn't need help from anyone on the, we just did everything from the football side. You know, you talk and you interact with these guys. And I'm talking about as a scout.
Yeah, like Torrey Hunter and those guys.
Yeah, all those guys. We talk, said, trust your opinions, don't allow a group of people coming up to you and saying, hey, what do you think of this guy? This guy's pretty good. I think he's pretty good. Or what are you thinking? I was like, yeah, keep your evaluations to yourself. As if we're going to get a fair evaluation of a player, we don't need a campaign. And those were the things that I despised the most from the time I started scouting to the time, being a general manager, was campaigning for a guy, because you found him or because you liked him or because, a friend of yours recommended him. I didn't really care about that stuff. It was, can he help our football team? Is he one of our best players, and can he help us win? And that was really it. So I know it was a little different for some people to get used to, but I'm not interested in the campaign. People just, hey, I got my guy. Say, no, this is our team, and let's move forward and try to get better in that regard. But getting back to the point of the, with the offensive lineman, that was always the early tricky one, for me, was when I, started evaluating, only because, you look and you say, man, this guy. And it's, Danny and those guys would say, no matter what you think of him, they're going to be playing, no matter what, one of them's going to be drafted. One of them's going to be this. And you see, like, man, they're not, they're not as quick. They're not this. They're not that. It's going to take a little time. But then you say, well, some's going to end up playing and some's not. But you had, that was one of the hardest things to really transition, because, when you play with one, play the guy, you look, you go, okay, he's starting, he's in. And then you don't really pay much attention to the offensive line play or position play when you're a player. And then when you're scouting, you're really forced to like break down individual players, and you start really looking and you say, man, he's got a ways to go before he's ever going to be able to start at this level. And, so you start grading what you see, but you have to grade them according to who they're compared with.
Now, you played offense, obviously you're a quarterback, and then as a receiver, the majority of your career. When you got into scouting first, when you retired, was there a position that you had to work harder at, you felt, to scout properly?
Yeah, the offensive line.
Was it just the offensive line?
It was the offensive line was number one. It was, tackles. Again, you look at a guy, you get them on the field, and you look at a guy and say, oh, he should be able to do it, and all the measurables and numbers suggest that he should be able to. But then when, you watch them play, or practice, and you're thinking, okay, he's not his upper body's not as strong, or whatever the case may be. But anyone who was worth anything, as far as the tackle is concerned, they stayed. They were in the NFL, where they were on a practice roster or whatever. So you were, you had to go out and dig to, to find guys and make sure that you were able to, locate a guy that could play tackle in this league. And sometimes you had to find out a guy who was playing guard whether he could play a tackle in this league, from the U.S. So, that was the one that was a little bit, in the first couple of years, it was, and then I would ask questions. And then once I started going down to the NFL and asking those guys, questions about the evaluation of offensive linemen and starting to really listen to those guys, because that was something that was just, that I had to learn, it became more of an understanding. And they always tell you it's not rocket science, but you want to make sure that you can get a guy that can handle his own on the outside, especially if it's going to be a left tackle. He's got to have the quick, the feet, got to have the length, the range, and he's got to be, able to at times block on his own. So I think that was probably the number one position, the one that I had to continue to keep an eye on and work hard at.
What about defensive backs? Because a lot of the ones, especially to have no CFL experience, you're scouting them as either a strong safety, there's one less guy in the field, and now you're going to bring them up to the CFL. And I've talked to a lot of players who think that's probably the hardest position to adapt to in the CFL is a defensive back, because you're coming up here. Now all of a sudden you got a halfback, right? Or who's never seen the waggle. Mm-hmm. And I don't care how good of a cover guy is, it's going to take him some time to adjust. So what did you learn over time to say, okay, these are the three things I need from a guy who's going to play halfback for me in the CFL, even though he's never seen the waggle. What would he need when you were scouting?
Good feet, and he had to have good eyes, basically recognizing plays that would come out. So you got to be able to look through to the quarterback and also recognize patterns. But the biggest thing that I always found is that a great athlete can do anything. And if you get a guy who's a good athlete, who has good feet, and who can run, that has played some defensive back, he should be able to adjust. And people say, oh, the waggle is so hard to deal with. It is a difficult, but the way I would always explain it to the defensive back is that it's very similar to basketball.
Okay.
Right? So stop thinking of it as a receiver that's getting a running start and he's going to run past you. Think of it as being on the basketball court and adjusting to the leverage that the receiver is running at you, because you have the speed to be able to run with him. You have the size to be able to withstand any type of pushing or shoving that the receiver would do to you. And more importantly, you have the feet to be able to, and the quickness, and when he does break down and change directions, you should be able to change directions with him. So, a good defensive back, has to be able to do those things. You obviously want them to be able to catch the football as well. But when it comes down to it, the defensive back, I didn't really find that as difficult of a position to evaluate as most people try to make out. I think what you find is that every, different coach may have a different view on how he wants the defensive backs to play. Some guys want tall, rangy guys. They may not have played a whole lot of defensive back, but they have the range. Some guys like short guys, 5'10", 5'9", that are quick, and they're all over the place. It all depends on what you want. I prefer to have the longer, bigger guys that are able to make the window small for the quarterback. And are you going to give up just a little bit in far as coverage ability to be able to get a guy who can run and be able to close that window when the ball comes? Yeah, if you can get the best of both worlds, that guy's probably starting on Sundays in the NFL. But there are guys out there that can adjust. We've seen it over and over and over again. So, this league, when you have one great defensive back and he's gone, people are like, oh, what are you going to do? The next one comes in. When we brought in, Aaron Grimes, it's the same thing. Like they're always out there and they're going to be able to adjust. It's just a matter of a guy getting the opportunity. Some like to go in and dive into veterans, get this veteran, get that veteran. And me and Torrey Hunter, we joke about it all the time when we were working together, is that, there are coaches that want to develop, and then there's coaches that want to coach. And it's no knock on either side, but there's coaches that don't mind young players that will bring them in and work with them, see the raw ability and the talent that they have and take it and understand the big picture, the long-term vision of what this player potentially could bring to the football team. And then you have the coach who doesn't want anything to do with the young player, just wants, sign me the veteran player, bring me the guy who knows what he's doing so I can do X's and O's, and then everything, life is grand. Well, there's a balance that goes there too, right? Because in a team, when you have salary cap, you have to be able to transition, and sometimes you have to look at your team and say, okay, where's the money going to be paid for this year and the next year? And if I played receiver, so receiver was a dime a dozen position, so was defensive back. So you look at those two areas, you say, well, we should be able to go on the road and find one or two guys a year to be able to fill these roles and be relatively inexpensive on the cap. But then when you start getting into the defense and offensive line, those are guys that you tend to want to stick around. So yes, you can go with youth at the secondary, you can go youth in the wide receiver, but when it comes to the secondary, I always believed that they're out there, and if you have patience and the guy has a skill, he will be able to develop into a player that you can depend on and rely on and feel good about, whether he's a rookie or not. Rookie just happens to cost less and give you the same type of production. The veteran who costs more gives you comfort and you feel good about it. But I think there was a veteran released today from Montreal. It's just, it all depends on what you choose to bring in.
Ed Hervey joins us as always every Tuesday. Football 101 from 5 until 6. Got a lot of texts. We'll get to those when we return on Edmonton Sports Theater, TSN 1260. You're listening to the Jason Greger Show presented by Grand Villa Casinos. Free player rewards card. Every swipe wins. Daily prizes. Grand Villa Casino.
Portions of this hour brought to you by Big Rock. Stick with an original traditional ale, a reliable toasty malt, the perfect beer to enjoy the summer. That's Big Rock. Visit them online at bigrockbeer.com.
This is the Jason Greger Show on your home for Edmonton sports, TSN 1260. There's never much love when we go OT. I pray to make it back in one piece. I pray. That's why I need a one dance. Got a Hennessy in my hand. One more time before I go. Higher powers taking a hold on me. I need a one dance. Got a Hennessy in my hand. One more time before I go. Higher powers taking a hold on me.
5:48. Football 101. Jason Greger along with Ed Hervey every Tuesday from 5 until 6. A few questions. Hey, Ed, how much is the CFL on the radar of U.S. players now compared to maybe when you first started scouting or even playing?
Well, when I first started playing, quite honestly, the CFL wasn't on the radar for a lot of American players because the word out there was that if you went to the CFL, you were trapped. The contract structure back then, basically, you would come up here and you'd be lost for 3 years. And American players just wanted nothing to do with the CFL during that time, unless the NFL had no more use for us as players. When I was scouting, and the difference in the contract at that time with the option year made it more appealing to the players. But again, you can't enjoy what you can't see. And the CFL wasn't on television as much as it is now in the U.S. as far as ESPN and access and being able to watch it. And today's player, because the CFL game is on television, it makes the American player comfortable with the fact of knowing that there's another option out there. But the American players will still exhaust all NFL options before committing to the CFL. And that's to be expected based on, you know, the potential salary that they can get. And as long as the phone continues to ring from the NFL to a player, they're going to wait and wait and wait. But when you do get that player, if you can get him within, you know, 3 years of getting out of college, maybe four, you know, you're going to get a good player that you can get 5 or 6 good years out of. But what you'll find sometimes is that those players will wait 2 or 3 years before they come. And then next thing you know, you're getting him at 28, 29. And, you know, he's a shell of what he once was and doesn't have the desire. So you got to be able to filter through that as well as a manager and as a staff.
Lots more following 10, 12, 60. And how often did you feel you needed to watch a player to get a good assessment of what he was? That one comes from Dan.
Yeah, about 300 plays.
300 plays.
Yeah, 300 plays. Okay. If you know, we had the film of a guy, 300 plays to be able to, you know, properly evaluate, at least give my own opinion on it. You know, I also trusted the opinions of the scouts, you know, of Paul Jones and Rob Ralph and Torrey Hunter and the rest of the guys. You trust those guys as well. But if they brought someone, you know, I'd watch, you know, maybe 100 plays of a guy because I trusted those guys, their opinion. But then we'd also make certain that, you know, they got to mini camp where the coaches can see them and everyone will have an opportunity to select. But, you know, if you could get film on a guy, you know, typically about 300 plays would give you an idea who the player is because, I mean, that's pretty much their body of work in a nutshell.
Okay. So 300 plays. And do you find some players you look and say, you know what, like certain positions, right? Like nose tackle, for instance, like a lot of people are like, oh man, you look at the nose tackles. Well, in the NFL, just because of the size and the yard off the ball, most nose tackles would have to drastically change their body type to play in the CFL, no?
Yeah, well, see, here's the thing. People want to compare the NFL and the CFL and say, well, this guy can go and do this and this guy can do that. Remember, the NFL has 4 downs. And because of that that extra down, there's more running. And the NFL game is controlling the line of scrimmage, right? I mean, there's balls are still being thrown. You know, teams are throwing at an all-time high in the NFL. But, you know, when it comes down to it, you got to be able to run the football and stop the run. So the nose tackles that are down there, the three techs and one techs, as we call them, those guys are, you know, 310, 320, 325. And if you're in a 3-4, they could be as high as 330. So to come up here and to expect them to come and have the kind of impact that you would see some of the guys here have, you're just not going to get that same type of productivity because one less down, clock is shorter, more passing, more running, and it's just a different game for those guys on the inside.
Yeah, certain positions for sure. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, there's guys that could play in the NFL that probably would not have success in the CFL and vice versa. You just know it. And
we saw it with Ricky Williams.
You know, again, Ricky Williams was he the failure or was the offense
in Toronto?
Okay. You know, like you if you give him an offensive line that could move holes and do all these different things, Ricky Williams going to be something special because when he went back, he wasn't bad as a player when he went back to the NFL. So again, you know, his style of play may not have fit up here, but it doesn't mean that he was a bad player or was a player that just couldn't get it done. The one that you probably will be able to evaluate more when you say the quarterbacks, when you see quarterbacks who play in both leagues, if you have a chance to see that, you'll see quarterbacks down there and you'll look and say, man, he's all right. He's okay. And then you get up here and he can't make certain throws.